Good morning. My name is Pastor Joshua Palmer. I run the campus ministry at the University of Arizona. It's called the Hold Fast Fellowship. And before I begin the sermon, I just want to tell you, for those of you who are not familiar with it, a little bit about it, and then ask you for two things. We are a wonderful group of students, about 30, 35, who get together every Friday night for a dinner and a Bible study. This year, we are working through the basic doctrines of Christianity. We just did one on the apologetics for the resurrection. Can you prove that the resurrection of Jesus happened? Next week, this week on Friday, we'll do what happens to you when you die, and then we'll go on to the church and sanctification and the end of the world, because that's the end of that story, right? The two things that I would ask you for are simply this. One of the things that I do is I go around to churches to raise awareness for the campus ministry, because we can't exist without people and churches like you. If you would like information about the campus ministry, if you'd like to be on our mailing list, there's a table out back there with some information on it. More importantly, there's a clipboard. You can put your name and address. And about once a quarter, we send out a newsletter just letting everybody know what we're doing. If you'd like to support us and you still own a checkbook, which some of you still own a checkbook, there are self-addressed stamped envelopes back there. Please feel free to take one. We tremendously appreciate your support. If you don't own a checkbook, we have a website, holdfastfellowship.org, and you can go there, and there is a little button that you can press, and the internets will just take money out of your account, and if you really want, it'll take money out of your account every month, and we are greatly appreciative for that. The second thing that I would ask you for is prayer. This is a big year for us at the campus ministry, because we have been asked by our district to start a church down there. There's no churches within walking distance of the U of A. There's no Lutheran congregations within walking distance. So they've asked us to begin to work through what it means to start a church. So our goal is to have services up and running by July, so that when the students get back in August, we can have a place for them to go. And you all, of everybody in Tucson, know what work that means. So I would ask for you to pray for us. Pray for me, pray for the students, pray for the group of non-students who are planting this church and who are figuring out what it'll look like. So I deeply appreciate it, and I appreciate you letting me come. The text for today's sermon is the gospel reading. And in order to understand what's going on in the gospel reading, we have to do a little bit of historical background work, because otherwise we won't be able to get to the theme that we have for today. The theme for today is that the church is a family that values everyone. Now, to start with this, we have to understand where Samaria is. The gospel reading starts saying Jesus went from Jerusalem through Samaria, and he's going home up to Galilee. And so Jerusalem is down in the south. Samaria is this area right in the middle, and then Jesus lives in Galilee, which is up in the north. Now, everybody knows that Jews and Samaritans don't get along. It says so right in the text, right? But I want to give you an idea of how much they don't get along. In order to go from Jerusalem to Galilee, you got to go through Samaria, right? Easy. Most Jews won't. Most Jews will choose to leave Jerusalem, go out to the east, across the Jordan River, go up north so that they completely avoid going through Samaria, cross the Jordan River again to get up into Galilee. That's just the first implication of what's going on here. But it says Jesus went through Samaria, because you see, he had an appointment he had to keep. And he gets to this town, and he's tired because it's noon, and I assume it's hot because the Middle East is a lot like here as far as the climate goes. The disciples leave him at a well, and they go into town to buy food. And the wells at this point are these large stone tablets with a little hole in the middle, and the hole had a cap. But what they didn't have was buckets. You didn't take a bucket and winch it down like you would in the Midwest and scoop water up and bring it up. What you did is everybody brought a bucket of their own with them. There were these leather bags that had these wooden sticks that you would lock into place so that you could dip it down into the well. Everybody had one. You could collapse them and roll them up and put them in your back pocket for when you were traveling. It was fantastic. The disciples almost certainly had one of these with them. And yet somehow Jesus accidentally lets it go into town. Because he's got a plan. Because he's got a meeting. And then it says, it was about the sixth hour, that's noon, and a woman from Samaria came to draw water. And right away, we run into a problem. See, in our culture, it's perfectly acceptable for me to talk to a woman that I don't know face to face. But not in that culture. In that culture, if Jesus is sitting on the edge of the well and he sees this woman walking towards him, the appropriate behavior for Jesus would be to stand up and to back up 20 feet and certainly not to make eye contact and absolutely not to speak to her, because he needs to tell her, "You're safe. I'm sorry that you're in this uncomfortable position. We're not going to have any problems here." So that she can draw her water and she can go home. This is well outside of the village. There's nobody around. This could be an uncomfortable situation. This is what Jesus should do. But he doesn't. He says to her, "Give me a drink." The Samaritan woman, this is verse 9 in the text. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And this is a huge understatement. In fact, Jews hate Samaritans. And Samaritans hate them right back. Let's not be confused here. See, the Samaritans were kind of a mixed people. In 722 BC, so 700 years before Jesus, the northern kingdom of Israel had gotten conquered by the Assyrians. And the Assyrians did what most empires did at that point. When they conquered somebody, they took like half of the population and moved them somewhere else, and then took another half of a population from somewhere else and put them there. And those people had married the Jews that lived in Samaria at that time, which meant that they were mixed. They were a mixed race group. But then, to make matters worse, the Samaritans went and they built a temple on Mount Gerizim. And they said, "Those Jews down in Jerusalem, they don't have the actual true religion. We have the actual true religion. And if you want to worship God appropriately, you come to the temple in Mount Gerizim. That's the right place." Now, this did not set well with the Jews, obviously. But to make matters worse, about 300 years before Jesus is born, a Greek army comes from the north and comes down south, and it wants to destroy Jerusalem. The problem with any army in the ancient world, of course, though, is supply chains. They're a long way from home. They don't know how to get supplies there. So they approach the Samaritans, and they say to the Samaritans, "Hey, guys, do you want to fund our war against the Jews?" The Samaritans said, "That seems like a good idea. We don't really like those guys." So they completely funded the Greek war against the temple. And just to give you an idea, this was the time when the temple was desecrated for the first time. The second time. This is when somebody took some Greek king took a pig, threw it on the altar of God in the temple of Jerusalem, and sacrificed a pig. That's bad. And the Samaritans are the ones who funded that. But don't worry, the Jews got back at them. By 128 BC, so 100 years before Jesus is born, the Jews raised a big enough army to actually pay them back for this. Marched up into Samaria, burning everything on the way, got to the temple at Mount Gerizim and leveled it. Teach them. And then a couple years before Jesus is born, like 5 years before Jesus is born, the Samaritans saw their chance to get back at the Jews, and they snuck into the temple one day, just the day before Passover, and they brought with them a special present for the Jews. So that when Passover came and the priests went into the temple and everybody's really excited and they opened the doors, you know what they found all over the floor of the temple? Human remains. That means that you cannot use the temple for Passover, and there are human remains all over the floor. Now, do you understand a little bit what she says when she says to Jesus, How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? Because when he speaks to her, she's not just shocked, she's probably repulsed. They hate each other. And then Jesus answers, and he says, if you knew who I was, you would ask me for a drink. And she mocks him. Listen to what she says. The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." And she mocks him. You see what's going on here? And then Jesus offers her something incredibly tantalizing. Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again." And all of a sudden, her tone changes just a little bit. She's still not nice. She says to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." And we might be tempted to think that what she's basically doing is being a little bit lazy. She doesn't want to have to walk out, draw the water, and walk home again. But I don't think that's what's going on at all. Because when she says, "That way I don't have to come out here again," all of a sudden you and I, who are seeing this picture in our mind's eye of Jesus sitting there and her standing here talking to him from a little distance, and the sun is out and it's noon and it's hot, all of a sudden we notice that something is wrong here. There's something wrong with this picture. Why is she out there at noon? See, that's not when you go draw water. You go draw water in the morning so you have water throughout the day, and then you draw water at night so that you have water for when you wake up. And you certainly don't go draw water out all by yourself. All the women of the village go out together to draw water in case they have any problems. And all of a sudden we realize that there is something going on here that she's not being forward about. And Jesus knows it, and he calls her on it immediately. Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." The woman answered him with a half lie, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying I have no husband. For you have had 5 husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." And all of a sudden, the entire scene shifts. You can picture this woman's demeanor completely shifting. Jesus has just said something to her. Jesus has called out something that she intentionally tried to obfuscate so that he didn't know this about her, that she was this kind of woman, that kind of woman. And so she shifts. She tries to distract him by asking the most argued about question between Jews and Samaritans of the day. She says, "Oh, I see you're a prophet. Let me ask you a theological question," right? Let's not talk about my husband's and that whole issue. Let me ask you a theological question. When and where and how should we worship? In Mount Gerizim or in Jerusalem? You guys love talking about this stuff, right? Theological fights, we like that. And you notice, I think she's trying to distract him, but Jesus answers her literally. He says, "Neither here nor there. The time's coming when you will worship in spirit." And she goes on to say something kind of odd. She says, "Yeah, I know about the Messiah. That's fine. That's no big deal. Whatever." And then Jesus again answers her literally, "I who speak to you am He." And this is really important. What he does is he takes her from this very important theological question and he points her to a person. He points her to himself, to the Christ. And the result of this is she runs into the town. She tells everybody she knows, come and see a guy. Come and see a guy who told me things about myself that nobody else knows, that told me everything I did in my life. And her excitement and what she says gets everybody's attention, and they all come out to see Jesus. And the whole story ends, it's kind of wonderful, the whole story ends, they say to the woman, it is no longer because of what you have said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world. A guy writing in the 300s, his name was Ephraim the Syrian. He's writing 300 years after Jesus. He characterized this whole story this way. He said, quote, this woman tried to get the better of a thirsty man, showed dislike to a Jew, heckled a rabbi, and then was swept off her feet by a prophet and adored the Christ. The theme for today is that the church is a family that values everyone. Outsiders, misfits, people that are of a different ethnicity or race than ourselves, people who live in a different socioeconomic class than we do. But before we can go there, we have to stop and we have to notice something. Because if we go there, then I think that we'll have missed the point. See, there's this temptation when you hear a story like this and you meet a character like this woman, there's a temptation to think of her as one of them. Right? There's us and there's them. And the fact that the church is a family that values everyone means that we get to include them. But it's not the point of this passage. This story is not about Jesus reaching out to them, reaching out to others, reaching out to somebody who's not like me. The woman at the well is not them. The woman at the well is me. The woman at the well is you. And here's what I mean. She's out there at noon, right? Why is she out there at noon? Why is she not with the other women in the morning or the evening? Why is she out there all by herself? Because her life choices have alienated her from her community. They've alienated her from five husbands. They've alienated her from all the other women in the village who don't hang around people like that. They've alienated her from all the respectable men in the village. But most importantly, absolutely most importantly, they have alienated her from God. Judging by the nasty edge in her questions, this woman wants nothing to do with the other people in the village. She wants nothing to do with God. She says, give me that living water so I don't have to come out here every single day and walk through town and have to deal with all this. And as Jesus pursues her through this conversation, she scoffs. She diverts. She tries to distract him. Why? Because who she is and what she's done in her life has to stay hidden from God and has to stay hidden from everybody else in her life too. That, brothers and sisters, is alienation. That is isolation. And every single one of us has tried to do this at some point. We've tried to hide who we actually are and what we've done. We try to hide it from each other, and we've certainly tried to hide it from God. In my life, this comes in one of two ways, right? The first way is I do something. I do something that I know I shouldn't. I sin. I do something wrong. And then later in the day, I find myself not praying as frequently as I do or skipping over the time of the day that I usually pray because I'm too busy. Or I find myself kind of shunting off my thoughts so that I don't think about God. Why do I do this? Because I think I can hide from God. I think if I can just avoid Him, I don't have to confront what I did. That's one way. The other way this happens to me is I like to think that I'm a certain kind of person. I'm a good guy, right? Good guys do good things. I'm a good person. And yet my actions and my thoughts don't always match up with that self-perception. Sometimes I do stuff that don't fit with how I perceive myself. And if I followed those actions to their logical conclusions, I would end up discovering or having to admit to myself or to the people around me that I'm not maybe actually a good person. So I fake it. I fake it in front of you. I fake it in front of God. I don't acknowledge the reality of who I actually am, and I find myself hiding from other people, and I find myself certainly hiding from God, just like that woman. And on the one hand, I know this is silly. I know that God knows everything that I've done and exactly who I am. I know this. On the other hand, it kind of makes sense to hide, because I'm terrified to be faced with who I am actually and what I've done and what my thoughts are. Because I am worse than I would ever admit to anybody. Because you are worse than you would ever admit to anybody. To anybody else, to yourself, to God. But you see, there's something else too. You're worse than you'd ever admit, but you're also more loved than you could ever imagine. Notice that Jesus will not let that woman go. He pursues her. He continually engages her. It's almost like, if you want to use this language, he's driving her out of hiding. Why? Because he wants her as his. He wants her to be part of his family. He wants you so badly that he's willing to not just pursue you, but to take all those things that you've done, all those things that you are, to take them on himself and then to die on the cross. And there's this aspect of the cross that we don't like talking about, and in our art, we never portray because it's too hard to look at. There's a fact of crucifixion that we do not portray, and it's that crucifixions were always done completely naked. And we cannot bear that image, I think rightfully. But if you think about it, if you and I are hiding who we are and what we've done from God, the crucifixion, when Jesus takes all those sins on himself and then he hangs there, he is exposed to the entire world. All of this major cosmopolitan city walking by, and God. And that's my greatest fear. I think it's yours too. To be exposed for who we are and what we've done. But this is to be vulnerable to God. But this is the incredible thing about this. Now my sin, now your sin that we were trying to hide from God, that sin is not only known to God on the cross, but then Jesus takes it and he buries it. Buries it. So that I and you can be incorporated into the family of God. Just like that woman. And then, and only then can we finally look at those others. Because you see, it turns out they're not others, they're just like me. Jesus says to this woman, go, call your husband, bring him here. And when she sees the love of God for her, when you see the love of God for you, now she wants to share this with anybody who will listen. And it's through her witness, right? If someone like me could be brought into this place, well, then you could certainly come in here. It's through her witness that that whole town gets to meet Jesus. Because the church is a family that values everybody. There's an old joke from Groucho Marx, and I'm told you should always end sermons with Groucho Marx jokes, right? There's an old joke from Groucho Marx. At one point, he quit a club that he was part of, and he wrote a letter saying why he quit this club. It was called the Friars Club. He said, I don't want to belong to any club that would accept me as one of its members. The Christian church is exactly the opposite and says exactly the opposite of Groucho Marx. Christianity says, if he could accept me, oh, they'll surely accept you. Come on in. Because we are worse than we would admit to anybody, and that's true, and Jesus knows that, and he still wants you because you're also more loved than you could ever imagine. Amen. And the peace that surpasses all